We could tell. The little neon lights that were the volume indicator lights on our old Pentron tape recorder started blinking. We knew we were getting something. About that time, as I said, pandemonium broke loose in the room. People went tearing out of the room to get a better look at the object. One person tripped over a beautiful floor lamp and smashed it to smithereens. Tripped over the cord. It was dark in the room. People were running into each other, all trying to get outside at once. I think I ended up being the only guy there minding the shop, you know, watching the tape recorder. So after calm returned, we sat back and everybody came in. The UFO took off. It left. And we thought that was the greatest thing we'd ever seen happen to us. We sat down, we rewound the tape, played it back, and sure enough, there was a message in voice. And very briefly, the message in voice was, number one, they had approved what Mr. Williamson's lecture had been about, gave him a little compliment. Secondly, they did offer a few suggestions. They said that maybe he should stress something else or two in his talk. Then they said, we would suggest that you call Mr. Adamski, because within 7 days, Mount Palomar is going to be shaken. And they mentioned the San Andreas Fault. Well, us Michiganders didn't know anything about the San Andreas Fault. For all we knew, it was a town. Never had heard of it. Well, we put through a long-distance call to Mr. Adamski because Williamson says, Richard, he lives at the base of Mount Palomar in a little town called Palomar Gardens. And that's where he's photographed all these UFOs with his telescope in his backyard. And he's right at the foot of Mount Palomar. So we tried to call him. We couldn't get him. He was gone. So we thought, well, George, whatever's going to happen, you're going to have to weather the storm. Well, we didn't have access to anything other than the wire services. Sure enough, 7 days later, in the Detroit papers, was a little article saying there had been a mild earthquake at Mount Palomar, registering such and such on the Richter scale. That was all the verification we needed. Mr. Williamson was excited. We were excited. Now, we're going to continue the story because it gets more interesting as we go. But I think at this time, why don't we take a 10-minute break? I would like to ask you, as Maynard has earlier, to please hold on to your slips so that you can write your questions down. We're not going to collect them right away. We'd also like you to know that if there's anything you would like to see over here at these tables in the way of either printed material or tapes, go over and talk to the ladies there. They're very nice. And we'll see you in 10 minutes. Another radio message. And this was the most unusual one to date. I was working in our office. Sunday was the day that we used to work on what we call the dog sets. Those were the TV sets, you know, that you just couldn't find out what was wrong with them normally. And so we'd save these for Sunday when the phones weren't ringing and things like that. And we could work on them kind of without interruptions. So on this particular Sunday, I was working. My partner was out. He was delivering some television sets back to the people. And the radio was sitting down at one end of our service bench. And along about 1 o'clock in this Sunday afternoon, shortly after lunch, it came on. Now, the last communication we had prior to that had told us to turn to a different frequency. I should mention that out. All of the radio messages came in at the same frequencies. They were all over the place. And at all hours of the day and night. At 1 o'clock in the afternoon, in International Morse code, only the second message that we had ever received in code came in. And it went something like this. We have need to speak with you. We would like you to drive out to the location where you normally receive our messages and be there as soon as possible. In addition, we would like you to leave a note for your friends to be out at that same location at 2 o'clock in the morning, at which time we will communicate another radio message. Well, this place that they were referring to, where we normally went, was a place out in the country, away from Detroit, about halfway to Ann Arbor, just off of Highway US 23. It was an old abandoned cemetery, and it was about 100, 200 yards off the highway, and it was hidden from the highway once you got in there. The reason we had chosen this spot was twofold. The first was that since we were receiving these radio messages at all hours of the day and night, but mainly in the wee small hours of the morning, we had had some embarrassing experiences with the police. First of all, there were several ladies in our group. And one of the places one night we had stopped to receive this message was in a supermarket parking lot. There we were, sitting there about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning with the lights out, waiting for the message. And up drove a patrol car. The officers got out, and one came up to either side of the car, and he looked in there, and he saw four or five people sitting in the car with the lights out, and two ladies amongst us. Well, they wanted to know what we were doing there. And we knew that if we said, we're waiting for a message from outer space, that, you know, they'd have thrown the key away. So, we told them that we were ham radio operators and we were waiting for a radio call from another ham radio operator, and we showed him our driver's licenses and our ham radio licenses, and the officers took everybody's name down in the car and they took the license number of the car, and I suppose if we'd have had a burglary in the neighborhood, we'd have been it that night, but fortunately there were none. So, in order to avoid this type of thing, we had gone out to this old cemetery because the second reason was that way out in the countryside, we were in a radio quiet location. We didn't have the snap, crackle, and pop of automobile ignitions on cars going by in our shortwave radios, and we didn't have the frying noise that you get from power lines, which make radio reception very difficult at the high frequencies. So we had gone out to this area, which was, I say, about halfway to Ann Arbor, Michigan, from where we were, and nobody bothered us in the cemetery in the middle of the night, I guarantee you. It was pitch black out there at night, and it was beautiful. We used to take our telescope along with us to sit there and look at the stars and maybe hope to see a UFO or something, and just turn the volume up on the radio so we could hear it. We'd all stand outside on a nice summer evening. Well, anyway, that's the place where they had requested we go, out to this place. Well, my car, my partner was using, and the only vehicle present at the shop was our company truck. It was a panel truck. And I felt a little guilty about this because normally we don't take our panel truck out to the country because it had all types of television equipment and so forth in it. But we did. I did on this occasion, and I left a note for my partner, and I said, Don, I had a message from the boys. Play the tape, and you'll hear it. They want you to be out at the cemetery at 2 o'clock in the morning for another radio message. And I took off. Well, with Sunday traffic, anybody know what a Sunday driver is? Okay, I didn't have very far to go, maybe 15, 20 miles, but it took me an hour to get there. So I didn't arrive out there to the cemetery until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And it was a beautiful Sunday. It was like it was here today. A cloudless sky, the sun was shining nice and warm, and just a gorgeous day. And everybody and his brother was out taking a Sunday drive. So I got out there, I pulled the truck off the road into this little roadway that went into the cemetery, far enough to where it was not visible from the highway. It kind of dropped down in between a little gully, and we were out of sight of the road because this highway was patrolled, you know, by the state police. And I thought, well, they would inquire about a business vehicle parked out there in the boondocks. So I sat there and I waited, and I had the radio in the truck turned on, thinking I'm going to get a radio message. And I had a tape recorder, a little battery-operated tape recorder with me, and said, I'll just tape it when it comes in. Well, I sat there and waited maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and nothing at all happened. Then something did happen. I just happened to be standing outside the truck, and I was looking around, and off on my right-hand side was a little hill, maybe 20, 30 feet high. And something caught my eye, just a flash out of the corner of your eye, and I happened to glance up. And there, as I stood and watched it with my mouth, I'm sure, hanging clear down to my belt buckle, was a UFO. It was coming down at tremendous speed. From the instant I first saw it as just a tiny silver speck in the sky until it hovered over the hill, not more than 100 feet away from me, I don't think it took 5 to 6 seconds to make the descent. I had a friend of mine later who was a commercial artist recreate the scenes. We have these on slides, which I'm going to ask our assistant over here to turn on for us. And this was a California artist. He was not familiar with Michigan topography. So the hillside does not look like Michigan. I think maybe that can be focused in a little bit better. That is what the object looked like. You can see way down in the bottom left-hand part of the picture, a fellow with a red jacket on, that's me. Michigan countryside, by the way, has a lot more brush and things than this. This looks to me more like Palm Springs or down south, Southern California, and that's it. This object was metallic, aluminum, magnesium in color. I estimated the size to be about 150 feet in diameter. It looked like maybe 50 feet high at the tallest part because it was tilted on its side a little bit when it came down, and then it flattened out. And it hovered about 12 feet off the ground at the top of this little hill off to the right. Well, I stood there transfixed. I didn't know what in the world to do. So I thought, well, if I'm ever going to see one of these things up close, now's my chance. So I started scrambling up the hill. Now this object, because it was up high, was in plain sight of US 23 and all of the cars going by on the highway out there. I walked up the side of the hill as fast as I could. And as I approached under the edge of that vehicle, which happened to be absolutely flat on the bottom, I was wearing a short sleeve shirt underneath my jacket. The hair in my arms just stood right straight up, and I didn't think to look at what was happening to my head. And I wondered often if maybe my hair was standing right straight up. But it was just like you had entered a high voltage electrical field, and everything was just sticking out. Other than that, there was no harmful effects. And it dawned on me that this object had moved at fantastic speed to descend as fast as it did. There was absolutely no sound coming from it, and there hadn't even been a rush of air from such a huge object descending that rapidly. Normally, you'd have thought there would have been a thunderclap, or at least you'd have a good strong breeze from something that big moving that quickly. But there was no breeze from the object and absolutely no sound. It was silent. I walked up under the edge of the object and something very strange happened. Could we have the next slide? There was an opening at the outer edge that opened up, a doorway in the bottom, and a stairway came down out of it. I kind of thought to myself, hey, this is just like taking a flight on TWA or something. And a man appeared at the head of the stairs. He was dressed in what appeared to be a brown suit of, well, it looked like coveralls, the only thing I could think of. And He wasn't more than 10, 15 feet away from me, and he stood at the head of the stairs, and he raised his arms, and he motioned me to come aboard. Now, the bottom of the stairway did not touch the ground. The first step was about a foot off the ground, so I had to jump and grab the side rail there to get onto the first step, and then I felt I'm committed. And a lot of thoughts went through my mind right about that time, but I remembered all of the radio messages we'd received, and I had never detected in any of them anything of a negative nature. These people had seemed to speak in very positive terms, very friendly terms. So I thought, well, this is my chance. So I decided I would move, and I did. And I got on the stairs and went up to the top of the stairway. When I got to the top of the stairway, the gentleman there didn't say a word. He just motioned me to step aside. And the minute I left the stairs retracted. And if you'll change the next slide, went back into a little compartment, the opening, what I would call like a hatchway in the floor, closed. And we stood there till all of this happened, which took maybe 15, 20 seconds. Now, we were standing in a circular hallway, which apparently moved all the way around the outside circumference of this ship, and right off to one side of us, going towards the interior, or what had to be the heart of the vehicle, was another long hallway. He motioned me to follow him, and we went down the hallway towards the interior of the ship, not the hallway circling around the outside edge. When we got to the far end, there was a doorway, and it was closed. And he did something with his hand, which I couldn't see what he did, but suddenly that doorway slid aside. And we walked through into a room. If you'd like to change the next slide. This room, standing just inside the doorway, looked to me at that time to be about 90 feet from the wall I was standing by across to the opposite wall, the far side. It looked to be at least 30 feet tall to the top of the ceiling, and it was a domed ceiling. This fellow immediately turned around, went back to the door, and the door closed. And here I was standing in the room. Now, I noticed that there was a person seated at a desk out in the center of the room who was wearing a white suit of coveralls, and his back was to me. And he was ignoring me, because he was busy doing something. He didn't say anything, and the other chap hadn't said anything to me up to this time. So I just stood there, and I looked around the room. Now, I would like to bring to your attention the color scheme. I hope you don't all laugh when I tell you this, but those walls, those pink walls there, were actually done in a form of marbleized finish. And the only thing I could think of, so that I could describe it later, was, have any of you ever seen a toilet seat cover that had a marbleized finish on it? I don't know if any of you have ever seen those. They used to be popular years ago. Anyway, it was kind of a pink mother of pearl type of thing, and it was a marbleized finish. The ceiling was blue. Lighting in the room was indirect. There were no shadows to speak of. And directly across from me, there appeared to be what looked like six either windows or the only thing I could think of is six of the biggest TV screens I'd ever seen. Rectangular screens. The only problem was that they looked like they were made out of ground glass. They weren't polished glass like we saw on the face of a television picture tube. And none of them were lit up. On the left was another bank of equipment that looked like it had two sets of windshield wipers going. There were two wipers moving up and down in a vertical plane, and next to them, two wipers moving back and forth in a horizontal plane, except they were wiping at the opposites to each other. And closest to that end of equipment that you see on the left was what appeared to be a newer piece of equipment because the finish on it was a little bit shinier than the rest of it. The rest of it looked like it had dulled a little bit. The floor looked like it was kind of a satin magnesium finish, and most all of the metals so far that I had seen in this thing looked almost magnesium in color. There was not quite as much reflection in the floor as the artist showed in the picture here. By the way, these drawings were all done in pastel chalks. These are not paintings, but chalk drawings. To my left and to my right from where I was standing, there were also two more curving sections of equipment. And on the curving section that you can't see, what would be your left, there were three seats in front of that section of equipment. This equipment looked like it was approximately 5 or 6 feet away from the wall, so there was plenty of room to walk behind it. And I also noticed what appeared to be the outline of a door, similar to the one I had just come through, on the opposite wall of the room directly across from me. This would be a view of almost of my standing in the doorway, except, again, the artist drew it from an elevation where I'd be quite high up on the side of the wall looking at it this way. All right, about this time, I went and looked back at the desk in the center of the room, and I saw that there was a chair, an empty chair, facing this gentleman on the other side of the table, and it was empty. Now, I would say that maybe by this time, a minute or two had gone by, and I was busy drinking it in. I had never seen anything like this, obviously, in my entire life, and I was absolutely fascinated with it. About this time, this gentleman stood up, got up out of his chair, he turned around, and he walked over towards me. And I thought he started to raise his right hand and arm, and I thought he was going to shake hands with me. So I stuck my right hand out to shake hands with him. His hand, however, went right on by mine. And he turned around, and he laid his hand, palm down, on my shoulder. And the first word I heard spoken was, "We're glad you're here, Richard. We have a great deal to talk about." And with that, he took me by the arm and he led me over to these chairs I mentioned to you that were on the left that are not in the picture here. And we sat down and we started talking. And we talked and we talked and we talked. I asked him a lot of questions and he did a lot of talking to me. He didn't ask me any questions, however. I found out that his name, or at least what he was known as, was a name that was spelled S-O-L-T-E-C, pronounced in our language Soltec. But I found out that it really wasn't his name, it was just a title. Now, this gentleman, and I said, we sat and we talked for many hours, looked like what I think you're going to see next. Would you change the slide? This is how he appeared. I estimated his age to be maybe 40, 45 years old, very fine featured, slightly graying at the temples, hair very neatly cropped. It was not a brush cut, however. It was just long enough to lay down. His eyebrows were arched, as you see. He had kind of a quizzical look in his eyes. His complexion was what I would call a tan olive, almost like a Spaniard, practically, in terms of complexion. Skin was very smooth. He had no traces of any beard. I wanted to ask him about that. Very neat. His clothing was very much like you see. The uniform or the clothing he was wearing had a soft collar. The material was very soft, kind of a metallic weave in the fabric. It was shiny. It didn't feel metallic, but it looked that way. It was one piece. There were buttons used as a fastening. However, the buttons were concealed behind a flap. And
Those are not epaulets on his shoulders. Just the way the shoulders were constructed in this piece of clothing that he had. There were no signs of any military insignia of any kind. This outfit that he was wearing was completely unadorned. He didn't even have a fountain pen in his pocket. So that's what he was dressed like. And he had on a pair of soft boots made out of the same material, no leather. We sat and we talked, and we talked and we talked. And we talked about many things, which we won't go into tonight because that would take maybe just as long as I took with him. But needless to say, I had gotten onto this vehicle at 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. The first time I happened to glance at my watch, it was 11:45. A quarter to midnight. We had been talking all that time. I should mention something else. I did not feel any sensation of movement. The air was perfectly easy to breathe. There was no problem breathing the air. It smelled just like ordinary air to me. This gentleman spoke perfect English, very cultured English. Another thing, I didn't get hungry. I did not smoke a cigarette. And I did not have to go to the bathroom. Now that may seem strange. But for 12.5 hours, it seemed like all of my physical processes, such as hunger, appetite, desire to smoke, thirsty, and so forth, were almost suspended. At no time did I lose consciousness. And I touched this gentleman and I felt him touch me. In my opinion, he was solid and he was as real as you and I are. I don't think he was a mirage, and I don't think he was some kind of a ghost or a spirit. There were 4 other men on board this vehicle. Each one of them was very friendly, and each one of them came up and was introduced to me during the evening, or during the time that I was with them. We maybe would talk for a few seconds, and then they would go on about whatever their duties were. The lengthy conversation was with this fellow. All of them were very warm, very polite, very, very friendly. And never once did I receive any impression of anything but friendliness. There was no hostility of any type evidenced. They were very polite, very friendly and warm. This gentleman here had a look of such intelligence in his eyes that when you looked into them, you almost felt like you were drowning. I don't know if any of you have ever experienced a sensation like that, looking into another person's eyes. But I knew that this gentleman was a highly intelligent person. However, he did not talk down to me. And it dawned on me that the name Soltec had been the name signed to several of the radio transmissions we'd been receiving in the previous months. And I asked him if he was the same person. He said, yes. And I said, Soltec, there's something that's troubling me. And he said, what is it? And I said, the question of your radio signal. I said, one of the things that gave us led to a great deal of authenticity about you was the fact that we had never come across a radio signal quite as strong as yours. We used to have meters on our equipment called S-meters. And every time their signal would come on, this S-meter would slam up against the pin and feel like it wanted to go around for the second or third time. And I think sometimes we must have bent a few S-meter pins. So anyway, I said, your powerful signal, how do you do it? We've never heard a station as loud and with as solid a carrier as what you have. So we walked over to that shiny piece of equipment on the left that you see, the part that I said looked newer than the rest, and he pulled out a plug-in unit. And it wasn't any bigger than a package of king-size cigarettes. And he handed it to me, and I held it very gingerly. It was kind of a milky, opaque plastic. You couldn't see what was inside of it. But you could tell there was some weight to it, that there was something inside. And I hefted it in my hand, and I looked at him, and I said, "What is it?" He said, "That is our transmitter." And I said, "Well, how powerful is it, Soltec?" He said, "In your terms, it's equivalent to about 50 kilowatts. This did surprise me. I said, "How come you have so many of them?" He said, "We use a number of different frequencies. Each one's for a different frequency." All right. If you'll change the slide, Scott. Once during the evening, one of those vision screens I mentioned to you, the one in the bottom left-hand corner, turned itself on as we were sitting talking. There was no one else in the room except us. This gentleman had not done anything to activate it. It just suddenly came on. And the little lights that were alongside of it turned green. Now, earlier in the evening, I had noticed that the lights on all of them that were turned off were red. But this screen came on for maybe 20 or 30 seconds. As it did so, the lights on the side turned green. This picture appeared in color on it. He just turned as he was talking to me and glanced at it and turned back and kept right on talking. He paid it no further attention, and after 15, 20 seconds, the image went, just faded out, and the screen went blank again. I asked him, I said, "Is that the Earth?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Could you tell me what it was?" And he said, "It is not important." And I couldn't get any more information out of him as to what it was or where it was. But I knew that we had to have been someplace. We could not have stayed where we were. We have had to have moved. Because, as I said, that vehicle was in plain sight of the highway. And with all the traffic going up and down there on a Sunday afternoon, they couldn't have stayed there for more than 30 seconds without being spotted. And they probably were spotted while they were picking me up. Along about 1 o'clock in the morning, I said, "Soltec, part of the message that you used to get me out here was that there was going to be a radio communication with the other people in our group at 2 o'clock in the morning." He said, "Yes." And I said, "Do you suppose it would be possible for me to say hello to them?" I thought I was being a little bit crafty. I said, "I would like to tell them that I'm all right, because I'm sure by now they're worried. They've found the abandoned truck." Fortunately, I had thought to lock it. The only problem I had in my mind was my partner maybe deciding to, since he had a spare key, to drive the truck back to Detroit. Well, because I didn't know when this experience was going to end. And I said, "Soltec, I think everybody would be greatly relieved if you'd let me at least say hello to them." And he said, "Yes, you can say hello to them." I said, "Gee, that's swell, thank you." And we went ahead and we went on talking. Okay, about 5 minutes to two, this is 2 o'clock now, 2 a.m. Monday morning, 12 hours later. He asked me to accompany him out to the desk in the center of the room. And when I got there, I said, "What are we supposed to do, Soltec?" And he said, "Well, we're going to be communicating with your friends in just a few moments." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "Sit down in the chair." So I sat down in the chair where he'd been sitting when I first walked into that room. And I looked around, being a ham radio operator, for the microphone. And I said, "What do you talk into?" And I thought he was going to hand me something. He said, "You don't have to talk into anything. Just sit there and talk. They'll hear you." Again, he didn't touch anything. 2 o'clock came, and he said, "You can speak to them." Well, the first thing I said is, "Hi, guys, this is Dick. I'm okay. I'm with the boys." I had no sooner gotten that out of my mouth Then one of the vision screens across from me lit up. And there, in full color, was a picture of my six friends sitting in their car at the cemetery. Now, what I'm going to tell you is incredible. I had been an electronic technician. I had an FCC license, been a ham radio operator. I thought I knew a great deal about electronics. But whatever it was that these people were using to produce this picture was going through the roof of the automobile as if it didn't exist, because I could see the people seated in the back seat as well as the ones in the front seat. There were six people in the car. They were perfectly illuminated, and yet they were sitting out in the countryside where it was pitch black outside. There were no streetlights. Yet they were as well lit up as you people are here when the lights are on in this room. They were in beautiful color. I had never seen color like that. Remember, color television was just coming in the mid-50s. The view was from the front of the automobile at an angle of about 45 degrees looking down. Well, I was kind of speechless for a second, and I said, "Hey guys, guess what? You're on television." And right away I knew, if anybody's ever going to believe it, now's my only chance. So I said, "Don, you're driving and you've got your brown jacket on. Henry, you're sitting in the back seat and you're wearing a red necktie and you've got a blue shirt on." And I told this woman what she was wearing and everybody else in there as fast as I could spit it out. Because just about that time I felt a hand on my shoulder. And I looked around and Soltec was looking at me with the type of look that said, "My friend, you have gone too far." He said, "Richard, I will speak to them now." I said, "I'll see you guys later," and I got up. The image stayed on the screen all the time. I could see them all leaning forward, listening intently to the radio. The Soltec sat down, and he talked to them for maybe 2 or 3 minutes. At the end, he closed off, but he did not set a new schedule for another communication. He told them that I would be all right. Well, 2 o'clock Monday morning, all of us were working for a living, including those six people down in the car. As soon as the message was ended and they had been reassured that I was all right, they did the next logical thing. They turned around and drove back to Detroit so they could go home and get some sleep. Because no mention had been made when I was going to come back. They just knew I was with them and that apparently I was all right. The image faded on the television screen. Soltec and I walked back over to the chairs we'd been sitting in previously, and we talked for a little while longer. And then about 2:30, he gently took me by the arm again, and he said, "Richard, it's time to leave." And he steered me towards the door, and he chatted with me down the hallway, back out to the outer rim of the ship, and when I got there, the other fellow was there, the hatchway was open, the stairs were down. And he said, "Richard, we will see you again." And he turned around and he walked away. Well, I had no choice. I went down the stairs. I jumped off the last step onto the ground. It's 2:30 in the morning and it was pitch black. We have the next slide. I turned, and within just a few seconds, that vehicle started to move away. Now that it was pitch black outside, I could see a very pale violet bluish haze all around it. It tilted slightly, just like you see. And again, in about 4 or 5 blinks of the eye, it disappeared from sight without a sound. Can we have the lights now, please? Right, isn't it? 12 and a half hours. I was standing out there in the countryside, and the first thing I looked for was the truck.
and it was still parked there. My partner had left it for me. I guess he figured I was going to have to get back to Detroit somehow. We went over and unlocked the truck and got in it, started the engine, and drove away. I was going to go back to Detroit, leave the truck at the office, get in my automobile, and go home and get some sleep. To say I was excited was putting it mildly. I thought Soltec had been extremely clever in maneuvering the parting the way he did, because he didn't give me one chance to object to it. Because if I'd have known it was coming up, I'd have probably argued with him quite a bit. I was all set to stay. I was a single man. I had no attachments other than the mother and the father. And I'm sure, had he allowed it, I could have communicated with him some way. But I was ready to go and stay with these people. So the departure came rather suddenly at 2:30 in the morning. Well, I got in the truck and I drove back to Detroit, straight back. And I thought, tomorrow is going to be a busy day. Well, my friends, who had left it shortly after 2, had stopped at a coffee shop on the way back. They were all excited about the radio contact, me being with them, my talking to them, the television thing, the whole bit. So they had stopped at a coffee shop. And the time they had stopped in the coffee shop was maybe 20 minutes or so. 2 blocks away from the office, I'm driving the truck, and all of a sudden I see this car coming up madly, quickly behind me, blinking its lights, flashing everything, turning its lights off and on, and lo and behold, it's all these guys in their car. They had just caught up with me because of their stop. Well, they pulled me over police car style and over and angled in front of me. I jumped out of the truck. They jumped out of the car. We kind of hugged each other, shouted, yelled, screamed, and all that. Went back, got back in the cars, went back to the office. We stayed up all night. I didn't go to sleep until, I think, 4 o'clock the next afternoon, because we just sat and talked. Nobody went to work that day. Everybody stayed. We talked and we talked and we talked. Well, that's the experience of a trip. But in a way, it was just a beginning. Something fantastic had happened. As I said, we thought enough of that experience that we immediately sat down when the initial high of it wore off and started taking notes. We wrote down everything we could remember about the 3rd day. And so the 3rd and 4th day, I was just busy scribbling notes. We contacted Rick Williamson, George Hunt Williamson, the fellow who we'd been involved with, and told him what had happened. He said, I'll be right there. He apparently jumped on an airplane and flew back to Detroit. He arrived a couple of days later from wherever he was, and we sat and we talked. Well, Rick was going to be in town, and he was kind of in a lull between scheduled talks. So we were meeting over at this friend's house, people by the name of Quinnell. And I then discovered that Rick Williamson was a channel. Up to that time, I didn't know what a channel was. But Rick was a trance medium, and I didn't know it. Until one evening, he apparently had told these ladies about this, and they had prevailed upon him to channel, to bring through some kind of a message. So Williamson had laid down on a couch, one end of their living room, and went through an assortment of different wheezes and sighs and sneezes and whistles and bells and all kinds of funny noises. And suddenly his voice changed, and out came a very strange-sounding voice who was somebody by the name of Philip.